And here we go. Yeah. So thank you so much. I want to welcome Eddie and Sherry, Eddie from the Department of Health and Sherry from the Department of Public Safety with us this morning. And hopefully we can get an update really on just what the situation is with the COVID-19 infections throughout public safety. We know we have been concerned about OCCC for a while. And just to begin that conversation, Eddie, or whoever wants to come up first in terms of the Department of Health, is really the some of the things that we've been reading on the public safety's website about COVID-19 at OCCC.
Mark, just one moment. Did you officially convene the meeting? And if so, I'm asking for an added thing to the agenda.
Okay.
Did call the meeting to order.
Here's the official. I call this meeting to order at this time. Is there any concerns over the agenda, Martha?
Yes, I just want to add that we also have a quick discussion on Common Cause's letter concerning the election, the upcoming election. And you froze again, Mark, with a great look of concern on your face. Common Cause sent us a letter that you forwarded to us, Lisa.
Oh, Common Cause's letter.
I just want to add that to the agenda, please. Thank you.
You want to have a vote on that?
Okay. I move that we add that to the agenda.
Second.
Is there a second?
Vote? Anybody? Nays? Any
Ted.
Nays?
What's that? I'm good. I'm good with it.
Okay. We moved and seconded that we add a letter from Common Causes to the agenda, which will put we'll move it after updates on oversight coordinator position and commission budget, Martha.
Okay.
Okay.
It will be very good.
And just so the commissioners know, that was the letter I believe I forwarded you folks from my organization called Common Cause.
Yes.
And I don't have it in front of me right now, but we'll discuss it when it comes up.
Sandy Ma is at the meeting. I saw her name.
Yes.
Okay. So all in favor say aye.
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 Okay. All opposed say same. Motion passed. Thank you once again. So Eddie and Sherry, on the website, there is a matrix that showed the amount of inmates that were affected with COVID-19. Showed staff, and then there was a column that showed recovered, yeah? And it appeared to be that there was not much more new cases, just what we're hearing from in the newspapers, but I would like if you can explain how we're defining recovery and what's going on with the continuing efforts at OCCC, Eddie. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Marco, and good morning, commission members and others. So, Mark, for that one, I'd like to have Dr. Curtis speak to that. She's been working on a daily basis with OCCC and been in with OCCC. So
that's a loaded question there, Anne. Can you guys hear me all right?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, doctor. Thank you.
So just a quick introduction. I did pull up. Did you see my little PowerPoint? It's a really lame PowerPoint, but I sent it over to you. And I wasn't sure if this was going to be PowerPoint-ish or if we just wanted to chat. So I did both.
The PowerPoint would be okay.
Okay, I will. Let's see here.
Do I need to give you a power to do it?
Share sound. Ooh. I did. All right. You guys can see this all right?
No.
All right, so I'm Ku'uwehi Hiraishi. I'm a reporter, general assignment reporter here at Hawaii Public Radio. And my background, I'm from the Big Island, grew up in Hilo, went through the Hawaiian Language Immersion Program. So a lot of my background in language and culture, and then went off to Seattle U. I got a full ride, so it wasn't a it wasn't any bad rep for UH Manoa's journalism program, but I did go up to Seattle U to study journalism and came back and worked for a small weekly newspaper on the Big Island. It was a lot like Honolulu Weekly. I don't know if you guys even remember that thing. Dave, you do, and Anne too, but it was an alternative weekly. It was a sister publication on the Big Island, Hawaii Island Journal. So did print, got into TV because KGMB at the time, pre-merger, wanted to do some Hawaiian language news. So we produced a Hawaiian language news program for KGMB, and later Hawaii News Now gave us a half hour on the weekends to do the same. So got a little TV experience. I'd say I learned everything that I learned in my 4 years at Seattle University was nothing compared to the first week of working on the job in TV news here in Honolulu. So experience, I'd say, as much as you can get that experience, even if you are still at the university, working for Kaleo, volunteering and doing freelancing, the more experience you have, I think that is where you're really gonna learn. And then later on, took a little hiatus into PR because journalism doesn't fit the world in this program because this major, not for the money.
I think you're on the wrong day. Took a 5-year
hiatus to go do some PR, public relations work for the and needed the variety.
I'm trying to figure it out right now.
Cycle. And so went to go apply for a job at Hawaii Public Radio and actually got it. Was very surprised having no radio experience myself. But
is everybody, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. I don't know what happened. Doc, can we start again?
Yeah, no worries. No worries, Mark. So as I was saying, I'm gonna let Dr. Curtis address that question. She's been working with OCCC and Dr. Campbell every day, so she can address the question that you had, Mark.
And just to add in, myself and our epidemiologist, Josh Holmes, are just starting to kind of help and work with Dr. Campbell as well. So probably not the same level of the historical knowledge that she has. I can tell you that there were some tests that were just run last night from OCCC. They're still finishing them from some tests that were specimens taken primarily on the 15th and I think 16th, maybe one on the 14th. And I think there were a total of 7 positives out of 140. And they're still, we're still checking to make sure if they're not repeat positives or not. So that person never have a positive test before. And there's still some that are getting run. They had a little bit of lab issues, I think, yesterday. So, I don't know if that helps give you a sense that of the numbers or not.
Hey, this is Shari. Dr. Curtis, do you want to share a little bit information on how we started providing new information on the website on the recovery? Between active positives, and now we have a whole number of inmates who have since recovered. Thanks
Shari. That was a question at the beginning. I'm sorry. Yeah, so there are individuals that right now we're using time and symptom-based recovery, which is the best way that we have to determine that somebody's sort of recovered or is past their infectious period. So for those who have had a positive test, you use the start of symptoms if they have them, if not the start of that test date that they had. And from 10 days after that, then they're considered recovered. And the symptoms are continuing, or they have a fever, their symptoms aren't better. Or for those who are immunocompromised, it can be 20 days. So that's saying those individuals that have passed that time and symptom-based period. So those individuals are past the point where you would consider them or think of them as an infectious, but they have had a positive test. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. So you're saying that they were tested positive, mm-hmm. and then based on whether or not they had symptoms and a particular time frame, and then they test negative, then that's the recovery definition?
You don't do a negative. You don't do another test. Individuals, okay. scientifically, folks, or epidemiologically, folks are staying positive past the infectious period. So one of the in fact, something that I think is important to get out there as a message for those actually looking for housing or other things is that a lot of places are looking for or wanting to use tests and have a negative test to allow someone to be housed. And that's a little bit of a problem because there's individuals that are not infectious, but they're still gonna test positive. So it's not a test-based recovery, it's time and symptom. And that's really important. And I think advocacy for those that have been tested positive, it'd be really important to get that message out because we are seeing quite a bit of the housing locations that are wanting to require a negative test, even if you have a letter that shows that you are cleared, right? You are cleared by that time and symptom base, which is the gold standard right now to do that because of the testing positive past the infectious period. So I think that's something really important that we want to get the message out there so that individuals are able to get housed.
The Dr. Curtis, for the correctional population, after those 10 days, if the time and symptom based test or management is being used, they can then be mainstreamed with the general population?
They're not considered infectious anymore if they're not having symptoms. You know, their symptoms are better, they don't have a fever, and they've passed that 10 days as long as they are not identified as being immunocompromised or seriously ill and went to the hospital. In exactly where everyone is in a facility, I know there's also logistical issues of where people are being placed, and that Shari could maybe speak to a little bit more. But from a infection control perspective, once you have passed that time, it is okay for you to be with others, whether they are positive or negative.
Okay, just so, and thank you. That explains a lot, Dr. Curtis. Curtis, I appreciate that. Comfortable is the Department of Health in minimizing the cluster at OCCC.
Did you say, are we working to minimize the cluster?
Well, sorry. If you're on the website, we're seeing that 200 something inmates were positive, and then they got recovered. Is there still more positives coming from behind, or have we worked on a solution that minimizes that activity, knowing that some of those recovered may still be positive but not infectious?
Right. Yeah, it is. There's definitely been a much lower level. I think that things are definitely looking much better. I will say, as I mentioned, there are 7 that have been identified on this latest testing that are positive, that we're still trying to identify whether those are the older positives or the new positive, but those could be individuals newly coming into the facility as well. So they are doing testing. So yes, we feel very good that that the high number of active positives that you're seeing, we're getting past that now. And primarily much of the numbers are those older positives, but there are still some active cases that we're following and we're trying to ensure that each of them are looked at as quickly as possible. We're doing the testing going around and that minimizing any risk of transmission within the facility. And that's the same as you would have in a community too, right? I mean, there's going to be individuals coming in.
Yeah. Understand.
That leads to a question. This is Ted. How are you handling inmates who are newly admitted into the facility? That's one part. And second, what's the rate of the new admissions?
And Shari, you might want to talk about new admissions with that.
Yes. So we are testing all new admissions coming into our facility at OCCC. And yes, we have had a few cases of positives coming in from the community. So those, if they are symptomatic, they go to our medical isolation module. Other than that, any new admissions continue to go to routine quarantine. But now we are testing all new admissions into our system just because the community spread has been higher than prior to. For our admissions every day, we continue to have admissions from the courts, but we're still at that 20, 25 or so, you know, number. We still have no court transports with the judiciary for Oahu. And I believe that we are going to be in communication with the judiciary to see how we can work together to start up court transports. Maybe in October, we're just really taking some slow steps here so that we can work with the judiciary and make sure that everyone is comfortable to start up in-person court transports again.
Sorry, well, how long is the quarantine period for the new admissions?
14 days.
14 days. And at 20 to 25, are you able to, do you have enough capacity to handle the quarantine?
Currently, we have two modules going on, but again, don't quote me on the 25 day admissions because it just really fluctuates right now. It just depends on how much intakes they have. But for now, we are managing.
You said you test all the new admissions. How often are they tested?
What do you mean, how often are they
tested? Do you test the one time or do you test, wait a few days and test them again because somebody might come in as a negative, but convert to a positive in a matter of days, especially if they're in the same van as someone who is positive.
For that specific information, I will have to get back to you. I do not believe that we test as soon as they arrive at the facility. I believe our medical staff waits a couple days. However, this is something that we'll have to get back to you because I don't know the specific information from our healthcare.
So, but anyway, anybody who comes in is automatically put in quarantine.
And tested. Yes, yeah. Correct.
Okay. Now, I saw in the news that you're partnering with DOH to do mass testing in all the correctional facilities. And that's really great news. But how about the neighbor islands, CCCs? What are your plans for Hilo, Maui, and Kauai CCCs?
Go ahead, Shari. No, you go ahead.
They are part of our mass testing groups. However, right now we are prioritizing the prisons just to make sure that we are covering everybody. But yes, our plans do include to test the neighbor island CCCs as well.
Are you doing quarantine on the neighbor island CCCs for new admissions?
Yes, we are.
Okay, and I know quarantine on the neighbor islands would be very difficult because the lack of space and the lack of flexibility that you have in each of these facilities. So yeah, I know it's very difficult.
We could talk more about that in item 4, Ted.
Okay, one more question. How about staff? Are staff being tested regularly?
Shari, do you want to take it or me? Either way.
Are staff tested regularly at all facilities or are you asking if testing continues for staff at OCCC? What exactly?
Well, actually,
sorry, Ted, actually, trying to clarify your question.
Actually, all facilities, because, you know, I see the bulk of the positives among staff has been at O2OC, but we've seen some at other facilities too, as I recall.
Ted, let me, this is Mark. Let me rephrase that question real quick with along the same line, Shari. Shari, is Department of Public Safety given access to your staff, correctional staff at all the facilities for testing? Mm-hmm. Or are they expected to do it on their own?
So as part of the mass testing plans that is currently going on, that also includes staff, not just inmates, but staff as well. Staff voluntary, if they want to test or not.
Yeah, Mark and Ted, if I could, if it's all right, if I could jump in really quickly here and just give kind of an analogy in terms of what we've done at the state hospital, which I think which public safety is also modeling. So there is infection control protocols for admission. So we're doing the same kinds of things where everybody who comes in is quarantined in a specific way. And then they're also tested and stuff like that. So it's worked very well for the state hospital. And then if, just as there was a couple of days ago, if an individual, usually a staff member so far, is identified as being positive, the actions that we take are we do testing for that unit, we offer testing for the staff as well, and the expectation is that it is voluntary, and so people can take the test with us, but also are encouraged to take the test with their individual provider as well. And the idea is to kind of continue to support both staff and the facility in making sure that we mitigate, infection spread. The reality, I'll just put it out there. The reality is in a controlled environment like that, like the state hospital or the prison facilities, the reality is that the biggest kind of risk for infection is the people that are coming in and out. So the folks that are in there already are actually safer from any of the community spread than a lot of us are in our day-to-day lives. And the biggest kind of focus needs to be on the people that are coming in either as admissions or the staff that are coming in onto shifts and stuff like that. And so temperature checks, those kinds of things, and then making sure that staff also identify for themselves if they're having symptoms, that kind of stuff, that they don't come to work and that they work with their primary care provider to determine whether or not they are safe to come into the facility.
Ed, given what you just said about it's the in and out population that we're more concerned about because of the turnover rate, right. Concerns me that Shari just said that the prisons are being prioritized over the neighbor island CCCs. I believe the neighbor island CCCs need to be prioritized.
I'm sorry, and correct me if I'm wrong, Shari, but I understood it to be that you're prioritizing all of the prisons, or no?
Yes, we are prioritizing the prisons first, with the neighbor island jails to immediately follow. And we have worked with partners on the neighbor islands to assist us in the mass testing as well, which has taken extra coordination.
And again, the in and out population goes into the jails much more rapidly than they go into the prisons. That's why I'm expressing my concern about that.
Yep. Okay.
And I did want to mention there was a question about is that time and symptom. That is the way that we determine recovery, not just for PSD. That's for everyone. That's the gold standard. And so I want to make clear that was not just something that's done just for Department of Public. safety. There was a question in the chat about that.
Okay. Thank you, Sherry, for answering that question. I just want to, you know, something you already know, it's and being a former correction officer on the line, it's so easy for the line culture to believe that administration doesn't care about what they're doing or what's happening to them. So it's always important to have to show that their conditions, their work conditions, their family health, and everything that's happening with them during this pandemic is being observed, watched, and managed. And help is there for them. Our staff is the key for the mission of public safety. And so those were my concerns, that their needs are being seen to as well. My second question, Sherry, we talked about 20 to 25 a day admissions at OCCC. I'd like if later you could give us some numbers on each of the jails on the other three counties, what their daily intake is. And I'm also interested, and because I worked at OCCC at one point in my career, what is the average of just the average releases right now? Because I know OCCC releases 24 hours a day. And so I'm just kind of curious to see how does the releases daily reflect the intakes coming in? And that could be information you can provide to me later. But I am interested in all the jails, what's coming in and what's going out on a daily basis, so we can get a sense of transmission potential that's happening at this time.
Mark, I would suggest that we provide PSD with a data request, and we list the type of data that we think would be helpful to us in our work as a commission. And give it to them in writing so they know exactly what we're asking for.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you, Sherry and Dr. Curtis and Eddie. Any commissioners have any more questions at this time for them regarding the COVID infections at the department?
Mark, I have a question regarding a pretrial release, which may be related to the population, if I may ask Sherry.
Yes, Judge, go ahead.
Okay, Sherry, under Section 353-36 of the Hawaii Vice Statutes, which was effective March 2017 and actually ended this past July 2020. And as you know, there's also a correction administration policy and procedures enacted pursuant to the release of misdemeanor offenders at the community correctional centers. My question is, this statute and procedure gives the Director of Department of Public Safety the authority to release petty misdemeanors and misdemeanors based on overcrowding. And an annual report must be submitted on the actions that the director has taken. So my question is, has any petty misdemeanors pre-trial pursuant to Section 353-36 regarding overcrowding ever been released? And if so, where is that annual report?
Judge, yeah, we can provide the annual reports to you or to the commission if you all would just include that in your request that Martha was asking about for the data. We can definitely include that as well.
Okay. Well, do you know if the director has released any pretrial petty misdemeanors or misdemeanors under this section?
Off the top of my head, Judge, no, I do not know. And I do not want to misspeak because I definitely want to make sure that we provide the commission with accurate information.
Okay. And so my next question is, this statute, it says that it expires July 2020 and was enacted 2017 in March. Do you know if anything has been submitted to the legislature to extend the life of this statute?
Off the top of my head, Judge, I do not know. I would have to double check with the intake service center.
Okay. So can we make that part of a request for the commission as far as the annual reports on the director's release of misdemeanors pursuant to chapter 353-36?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
Mark, can I second what Judge Ibarra is saying?
Yes.
That's a critical question. The government, public safety has to use sound discretion. We're not learning today whether they use it or not used it. To not use it would be abusing it. So I really think that's and I'm not blaming Shari, but I appreciate Ronnie Barra that question, because we don't need all these fancy way outs if the discretion is already there. So thank you.
And if I may add, there is already a policy in Department of Public Safety, policy number COR.16.11, to effectuate this statute. So I just wonder, as Judge Town said, whether the director exercises discretion to release pretrial misdemeanors.
I agree. Maybe the special master can, is Fred with us today, Mark? He's not here?
I don't believe so.
Okay, I wish he were here. Or we, at least when we talk to him, we'll reinforce that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Thank Mark, you, Sherry, for asking those questions.
Mark, go ahead. I had a few more. Shari, what's the timeline for the testing? You said you're going to prioritize the prisons. How long is it going to take, and when can you get to the neighbor islands? And the reason I ask that is I totally agree with Martha that, you know, the neighbor island CCCs is where you have a lot of in and out activity. They're situated in the communities, and the space is very, very limited. In fact, as I read the your plans for the three CCCs on the neighbor islands, I really have some serious concerns about whether the quarantine and isolation spaces set aside are going to be workable if it enters. And I, one this is commentary, but you know, I appreciate Eddie's comments about the safety once you're there and you're relatively isolated, but you know, the problem is if it gets in, it just takes off like wildfire, as we've seen not only at OCCC, but in all congregate living situations across the country, be there jails, prisons, care homes, cruise ships, et cetera, et cetera. So that's behind our concern about the neighbor island CCCs, to stop it at the front door as much as possible. So anyway, Shari, what's your timeline?
Absolutely, Ted. I totally agree with you. And we can provide our tentative mass testing schedule under a confidential cover to the commission.
Okay.
Yeah, so Ted, I just thank you. So that's the point that I was trying to make, is that from an epidemiological perspective, it's really about the once you have a quarantine site, it's really about how does the virus get in from the outside. And that to me is one of the things that is the most difficult part of, you know, planning for facilities such as these.
Well, you know, Eddie, I'm very familiar with all of the correctional facilities. At OCCC, you have 15, 20 different housing units spread out, so you can separate to some extent. But it's not like that at the three neighbor island CCCs. It's going to be very difficult to affect any kind of separation, meaningful separation. So I urge you to relook take another look at your prioritization of the mass testing. Because, you know, we've seen, look at a veterans home in Hilo, right? The patient goes out to get dialysis and comes back with it, and then the whole place gets it.
Yeah, exactly my point.
Thank you. God, I really want to thank the Department of Health and the Department of Public Safety for working so closely together. I know it's very difficult.
I'm going to take Ted's last comment. I'm going to kind of going to segue into the next agenda item, which is the status of the Hawaii Community Correctional Center. And so there were several topics I wanted to talk about. And since, you know, Sherry and Eddie, you're still here. And this is me, you know, without having any of the knowledge that Department of Health has. If you look at the concerns we had with COVID-19 spread here on Island of Oahu, and our population being well over a million, and once our numbers started getting high in terms of the positive cases that were being discovered, and at that height of those community numbers, somehow the virus eventually ended up at OCCC, okay? And the cluster began. With that kind of reasoning, knowing the population of the Big Island, yeah, and knowing that their numbers been high in relationship to their population, is there an expectation of the Oahu model of that virus getting into the prison anytime soon? I don't know if that's an unfair question. Maybe Dr. Curtis, the epidemiologist, might be able to answer something like that, or I could be way off my thought process.
Well, you know, that's what you always want to have in place is precautions in case, exactly against what you're mentioning. So when you're in the large congregate setting, you want to ensure that you're able to identify those coming in. That's why they are doing the quarantines for the 14 days at first, but it is always a concern when you have large congregate settings. And I think that's why everyone right now is trying to look at when can we get the testing done and what kind of strategies can we use. I was actually on a phone call this morning with jails and prisons across the country that are grappling with this as well and looking at how do you handle it with large congregate settings, what kind of testing can you use and what can you use within exactly as Shari mentioned with using testing at the beginning, quarantine setups with those first 14 days, and then if anyone at all is symptomatic or who's within there, or including staff, you know, continuing to educate about the importance of not working, or if anyone does have symptoms, it's within having those addressed and then tested at that time as well. And you really got to use that two-pronged attack of what of the individuals coming in, as well as having that continual education about masking, the physical distancing when possible, the masking, the hand hygiene as possible, and the worker health as well as others' health. So I think we're trying to use all of those strategies in place and continue to work on it.
Thank you, Dr. Curtis. Sherry, heard what I just said. You know, there is some concern from the commission on what's going on the Big Island. We've seen them in their own, as their numbers rise. I'm not sure if the Department of Health is able to identify west side, east side in terms of the positive cases. But, at first I thought if Hilo had a large numbers of that positive, that they may be more of a concern with HCCC, but realizing that a lot of whatever gets arrested in Kona gets sent to HCCC as well. So can you give us the status? There's been a lot of things going on the Big Island right now. Has whatever you're capable of discussing at this time, can you share any efforts specifically to the overcrowding situation at Big Island?
Mark, you cut off or you were frozen for a few seconds. So can you repeat what you just said? Thanks.
We just want to know if you could give us an update on the overcrowded situation in the Hilo jail. How are the releases affecting the population that was court ordered? And then any update or any changes that may have caused due to the riot that occurred? Did I freeze again?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Sharon. I'm being patient. Yeah.
So
some of the concerns, Sherry, is we've been getting a lot of some communication from the people from the Big Island that have been asking these same questions to us. So we want to be due diligent and be able to answer them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will have to find out again under Martha's request for the data at HCCC for the admissions versus the releases that we can get for you. As far as the riot that occurred at HCCC last week, it is still under investigation. As was reported by our department, we did move out the active participants to Halava Correctional Facility. And I know Warden Mahoy at HCCC and his building maintenance people are doing a great job in trying to clean up the after effects of the riot in the module. So, you know, that's kind of where we're at right now.
Commissioners, any other questions that you may have to have on the Big Island situation?
It's kind of like, where do we begin? Shari, as members of the commission, we're all aware that HCCC has been continuously one of the most overcrowded facilities in the state. Overcrowded to such a point that you folks are forced to use management cells for regular housing and use program spaces for regular housing. I hope that the commission has some impact on helping the state make decisions on how they will help relieve that overcrowding at HCCC, because it's inexcusable on the part of the state. Public safety has been stuck with this for decades. I'm sorry, that was a comment more than a question.
Mark, I want to second that. Once we set, if we set, or when it set the emergency capacities, which is next in the agenda, game over. You can't go beyond it. But the question is that an impossible request? So we may want to talk about it in the next segment, because that's to me, that's the guts of this discussion today. What is the emergency capacity?
All right, Mike Town, you're sounding like someone manipulated your video. And you're dragging. So
that's all I have.
You need to call your daughter and soon.
Yeah, we got the gist of it. Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Is it working, Martha?
It's okay, still anyway.
The emergency capacity should drive it.
Yeah. Your audio was dragging and you've just gotten frozen on your video.
You talked about the emergency capacity and you need to drive what we're talking about at this time.
Yeah,
we're discussing that in the next agenda item. Okay. Judge Ibarra, do you have any comments for the Big Island?
No, thank you.
Okay. I'm just going to segue. Thank you, Sherry, for those questions. And I know... you'll follow up on those issues. To my fellow commissioners, you know, there is no doubt that we're going to continue to get concerns about the Big Island. I forwarded some of them to you, coming from the public, asking questions. And as we go into item number three and we look at some of the more recent incidents at Halava and OCCC, we're reminded, and I'm just going to read from Act 179. The commission shall oversee the state's correctional system and have jurisdiction over investigating complaints at correctional facilities and facilitating a correctional system. Well, the discussion is just right there. To have jurisdiction over investigating complaints. Yeah. And no doubt when we talk about riots, and we talk about debts within the correctional facility, We need to have a common understanding of how we're going to define that particular piece in terms of investigating complaints. I'll kind of ask the judges if they can chime in on the beginning on what they feel is the role of the commission at this time, according to that particular piece of Act 179, so that we can have these the next discussions concerning the issues within the prison system that we are already getting complaints about.
Okay, Mark, if I may, you know, the Act 179, as you point out, part of the commission's responsibilities, investigation among others. But the bottom line is there are lots of responsibilities that our commission has to undertake, and without the full-time the facilitator, you know, we cannot do it as a commission, because what are we going to do? Each of us, or are we going to go into the prison and conduct our own investigation? You know, my take on this whole Act 179 is that's why we have, you know, full-time employees, because we're the ones that provide the policies and procedures, and the full-time employees are the ones, you know, that go into conduct the investigation, provide us with reports, and so we can make decisions. And that investigation is not only one of the responsibilities. As you know, there are other reports, monthly reports, that we should have been providing to the governor and the legislature, but without our full-time employees, we cannot pursue our responsibilities. That's the bottom line. We can talk about it, bring attention, and raise our concerns right to the public safety, and certainly, you know, but without our full-time staff, you know, we're pretty much hands are tied, so to speak. But thank you.
Judge Town?
I second that. I second that, Mark, you know, because we can say we want to investigate, but to effectively investigate requires quite an investment of time and energy and expertise as well. And we simply do not have that in terms of the time to conduct a proper investigation. So sometimes I feel reluctant to open any areas because I know that we cannot follow up.
And I want to add that for the public to know.
It'll be half-baked unless we have a really good staff. Look what goes on. And I've had calls from legislators saying, where's the money? I wish I knew where the money was. So we need to have full, robust hearings and pin the tail on the donkey, so to speak, sooner than later.
And I want to also stress that we have been doing a lot of work, and there's just so much we can do sitting at our homes and writing. And as the judge brought up, as Judge Ibarra brought up, doing the investigations is where we are really shortchanged.
Those are some of the things that I know is going on and wanted to hear and understand. Really, if you look further down, when you look at the oversight coordinator, it specifically talks about supervising and administer the operation of the commission in accordance with the chapter. And, you know, so yes, everything there is true. Yeah. And we may talk about that in another agenda item. But in the meantime, you know, among us right now, I guess the intent of me putting this on the agenda was to just to have the discussion of, yes, we know what the shortfalls of the commission is at this particular time in terms of we really being an effective investigative of complaints agency, but as also to affirm that, you know, and what we know already occurs within the Department of Public Safety as being part of that system for so long in terms of investigations and how they're being conducted. We do know that, you know, inmates have the opportunity to contact the ombudsman for whatever concerns they may have, the state ombudsman. We do know that each correctional facility in and of itself has their own administrative investigation processes. We also know that the Department of Public Safety, through their Internal Affairs Unit, has an investigative agency unit that looks into situations within the correctional facilities as requested by the individual administrators. And then, of course, we know that the attorney generals normally take on the big cases that have to do with work that the attorney general needs to resolve or settle within each of those prisons in the system. So we do know that there are investigative bodies that are in place right now to ascertain the incidents as they arise.
Mark, all of these investigative bodies have specific purposes, and in many instances, they cannot share the information. For example, if the attorney general goes in, they're going to look at it from a criminal point of view, and they cannot share their investigative product with us. Many times, as you and I well know, public safety, internal affairs will go in, and they could be looking for a criminal, conducting a criminal investigation, and they could be looking at an administrative investigation, which means to see if any staff were at fault, and they cannot share that with us. We're looking at our investigations would be on a different level, I think. With a different focus. We're going to be really looking at policies and practices and what can be improved. So it's very different. And I fully understand the different investigative arms that are in the system, but I think we can, our purpose is quite different.
Go ahead, Ron.
Okay, and you know, if you look at the 179, the purpose of the act, and you know, basically, we were created under the act because the legislature wants independent oversight of the correctional systems. So we are supposed to be that commission with independent oversight jurisdiction.
How do you define independent, Judge?
I suppose that we're not influenced by other agencies, and we make our own call after a proper investigation and looking at the statute, that we come to our own conclusion without influence of any other agencies.
But Ted, I kind of went through that whole thing based on what we know of public safety. And everything you said is what I'm trying to get at, so that the commission is on the same page in terms of what we're really going to be looking at. And what we're going to be looking at is really a macro view of the situation and policies and law, perhaps.
You know, Mark, I think this really brings us to another item on the agenda. The governor's appointment of a special master, and you know, I work with Fred. I respect his work. I respect what the governor wants to do, but you know, Fred is not independent. He works for the governor. He continues as the head of the parole board. His audience is the governor. Our audience is the public, the governor, the legislature, and the general public. So it's very different. And so the power, obviously, that the governor has over us is, number one, he appoints the coordinator, and number two, he controls the purse strings. And that's what has put us in the dilemma we're in right now.
Okay. Mark, can I be heard?
Yes, we can hear you.
Martha, I hope I'm not dragging. I don't want to sound like Nancy Pelosi. I was on the parole board, as you all know, 8 years, and we are a quasi-judicial group. We did not see ourselves as having to report to make people happy, the governor or the legislature. And I think that's who Fred is. And I think the special master, even though it doesn't come from the court, we've got to be quasi-judicial and pin the tail on the donkey and do it hard and not make nice or give anybody a back massage. So I have a little different view, and my guess is, or at least my hope is, that Fred's done October 1, but maybe, hopefully, he or someone like him will be the director of public safety. So I'm hoping for a quasi-judicial minister of justice that's hard-nosed and will pin the tail on the donkey. If something's wrong with public safety, say it. If something's right, say it. So that's my own, and I may be off on that, Ted, but I have a little different view.
Let's save that for the next item of discussion in terms of the special minister.
We're going all over the agenda right now.
Yeah, everything segues into each other. So I just wanted to have that discussion so we clear and understand what our role is, specifically to the current incidents that just occurred. And, you know, yes, the oversight coordinator would be our legs and our eyes to look into these situations and try to bring some resolution from our responsibilities per Act 179. But in the meantime, we need to look at how do we do it without the help. it's not funny, you know, but it's just confusing and frustrating at this particular point in time that we're not able to do some of the things because we don't have legs on the ground. So that's a discussion I really wanted to have so we understood where our responsibility is in these larger incidents that are occurring right now. And we continue to work on how do we look at asking the questions that can be answered in terms of responsibility and accountability for those incidents. This next topic is going to be one of interest. I'm going to kind of hand over to Martha. For those of you who are here, you could have the report was posted on the website as well. And Martha is going to begin and explain to us the emergency capacity at the correctional facilities that that was set by the commission in our report. Martha?
Okay, I'm just concerned we skipped over item 3, the deaths at Halava and OCCC.
That was what that discussion was about.
That's all it was about, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, what is our responsibility and how do we... get the questions you want answered. Yeah.
So many of you may be aware that I was the staff assigned to the 2001 capacity report. And the 2001 capacity report was looking at a very detailed analysis of each one of our facilities and the population that it was able to contain. And that included looking at the infrastructure, looking at the ability to, the amount of space that was available, being program space and living space. So our turn on this time is based on that report initially and stating more or less that report is still in place. Now, information or letters that I received from PSD made a comment that the 2001 report is not relevant today because of the changing population. Because of current conditions. That is not what capacity is about. Capacity is about what you can adequately hold without stressing everything in your environment. And that is what this new report is trying to express too. Using CDC guidelines, we applied that to the 2001 capacity, and the 2001 capacity only listed the operational capacity, but in this report, we've added the design capacity for each one of the living units in the facility. And what I want to stress in this report is we are not saying that the whole population of facility has to go down to this emergency capacity. It is supposed to be used unit by unit. So if you're using module 18 at OCCC, that's a 32-cell module for medical isolation or quarantine, it needs to be single cell. Where this made the biggest difference, though, was in the module. In the dormitories. And when I went to the dormitories, the Department of Public Safety provided us again with drawings of each one of the dormitories with the dimensions in them. And I'm sorry, I have not completed Wai'awa today as of yet because I'm still having a hard time seeing the numbers on that one. But using those dimensions, I then made the decision that for a dormitory that we have been double selling, such as Halinani Malka, which has a capacity of 100 inmates. Instead, not double celling, I'm sorry, double bunked, with the bunks approximately every 3 feet between the bunks. That would be the average space between the bunks. Instead, that space was increased to 6 feet between all of the bunk beds. And the bunks would be single bunk. There would not be two people, one on top of the other, in those bunks. And that drastically reduced the population that should be in there under those CDC guidelines. The CDC released two guidelines. One was in March, I believe, and then the second one was in July. And both of them stress that they, if people are in cells, they should be single celled. If people are in cohort facilities, which can be anywhere from like 2 to 4 to 100 people in one area, that there needs to be 6 feet around each one of those beds, which means the bunks have to be 6 feet apart. And also there has to be 6 feet from the foot of one bed to the bed on the opposite wall. Some of our facilities were large enough that they were still allowed to have bunks go down the center of it. There might be 30 feet between the end of one bunk and the beginning of another bunk on the opposite wall. And that's how this was done. Again, it is not a total capacity for the entire facility, just for those living units. So Mark, I gotta ask, what extent do you want me to go through this? Because we went facility by facility, it would take a very long time.
No, I just wanted to have that explanation out there so that those in attendance today can, as they're looking at the report that was distributed, they understand where we are coming from in terms of setting those numbers.
Yeah. And so these numbers, as I said, for the dormitories are below the design capacity for those dormitories in most cases. So I'm just looking at the first one, Hawaii Community Correctional Center, Waianui Nui, which had a design capacity of 20 inmates because it was looking at single beds, no bunks. For the CPMC, we said you could put double bunks in there instead of single bunks, so we increased it to 40. For the emergency capacity, given the size of the rooms that are available, we reduce that to 10. That is for the period of time that Waianui Nui is being used for either medical isolation or quarantine. It is not for the general population. If it is general population, it can go back up to 40. So it's a little bit more generous than what Dan Foley was doing for the whole facility, because he wanted design capacity throughout. But this would allow, what we just presented would allow for double selling if it is not medical isolation or quarantine, but it does drastically reduce the capacity of dormitories based on a case-by-case basis. And now I'm ready for any questions.
Ted, you have anything?
Yeah, I just want to add that, you know, we also have conditions, required conditions attached to the capacities and part of the conditions include things like out of cell time. And the out of cell time really is part and parcel of the 2001 capacities anyway. And the idea is, especially if you're gonna double cell somebody in a cell that's designed for one person, they should not be locked in for inordinate lengths of time. There has to be activity. Likewise, if you're gonna put somebody in quarantine, you still have to afford them some opportunity to be out of cell, to do things like make telephone calls, go to recreation, it might be difficult to socialize, but receive visits from people like spiritual advisors and attorneys. So I think I would ask people to pay attention to the required conditions also, not only the numbers.
I also want to note that after last meeting, Carrie Ann did do an email introduction with me and Dr. Miskovich, because I did mention at that meeting that we need to have health officials involved, but I made the decision just to go on with the way I was doing the capacities rather than involve someone else. But now that this has been published, we're waiting for comments, and there may be adjustments made based on those comments.
Mike or Ron? So just a recap on Act 179, where it specifically states on our responsibilities to establish maximum inmate population limits for each correctional facility and formulate policy and procedures to prevent the inmate population from exceeding the capacity of each correctional facility. This report that we published basically is our response to the pandemic situation that's going on at this particular point in time. Hence, the emergency capacity report is what we tagged it. So that was a lot of work, Martha. I know that was at least about 5 months of work. And
it wasn't that long. We were trying to do something else initially, but we changed our tack. So this was much shorter than doing that. But it was a lot of work going into it. You know, what I've noticed from the population reports, if you look at Wyava and KCF, Kulani, they have been, the number of inmates there have been less than their capacity. And we have, the department has twice provided us with the, how many people were in each living unit at the facilities. And for example, at HCCC, Hali Nani, which has two living units, was very underpopulated compared to the extremely crowded HCCC. So I would ask that the department really has to reconsider how they're using all their beds, not just the beds in certain areas, because to underpopulate one area, and I realize that that most likely classification is driving this, or status of the inmates are driving this, but there are other things we can do to further disperse the population.
Martha, I have a question. Does this fall in the lap of the special master public safety? This is a huge report and it's important and it must be addressed straight up. It's not an impossible thing, because it feels to me that we're overpopulated, the congregate care is dangerous, and I just don't know where's the ball? Whose court is it in?
The ball really would be in the governor's court and the courts, because population and corrections is driven by where admissions come from other agencies, and most of the release are also driven by other agencies. So this is not something that public safety can just enact on their own without commitment from these other agencies, which goes from police through prosecutors through courts, and then the Hawaii Paroling Authority, and the courts are involved both at the beginning and reconsidering bail. Public safety cannot do this on their own.
Okay, I think the special master has to take a cut at it. I don't want to let anybody off the hook yet. Maybe I'm wrong.
Mike, just to let you know that we did send this to the Department of Public Safety. They responded back. I forwarded the letters to you folks yesterday, requesting for a little bit more time so that they could respond to the report and its contents. Yeah.
And I want to stress that I believe us as a commission, we want to work with the Department of Public Safety on this. Mm-hmm. Our job was to come up with capacity analysis, which is what we've done in this. Public safety has a lot of questions on operationally how they can best protect the population and how they can, in their limited ability, comply with this. And we're here to help in any way we can with those items.
I just want to reaffirm what I said last time. I don't want to be too much of a broken record. These are not Amazon widgets. These are human beings that could get very, very sick. So I would hope that public safety, the special master, governor's office, move quickly. Thank you.
Mark, I just want to paraphrase what Martha said. Our job is to establish the capacities. PSG's job is to make work the population within the capacities that we establish.
Thank you for that clarification, Ted. With no further questions on the subject, it's something that we're going to continue to discuss as we get information from public safety and other agencies that choose to get involved. We'll just continue to move forward with what's happening at that time. With that being said, we can have a short discussion if you want, because we already said pretty much a lot about the special master for the Department of Public Safety. I have made some attempts to contact him, which has not been successful. But there is no doubt we want to have a relationship with his ability, his responsibilities in the short period of time, I believe, that he's been appointed. Now, if today is the 16th or 17th, we're looking at him only having another 2 weeks. Is that everybody's understanding? Yes.
I'm told it lasts till October 1 at the latest, and then hopefully there'll be a director appointed. I don't know who that's going to be.
Okay. So as part of the commission, as soon as I get in contact with him, I'm going to offer him our support of much of the things that we have been doing to help him in his assessment of what he finds in the public safety. We can be a sounding board for him with our experiences in both the judicial and public safety systems. And I'm just waiting, like I said, waiting back for that phone call so that we can have that discussion and see how we can be of help to him at this particular point in time. Yeah. But I'll stand by the remarks that you already said in previous agenda items concerning his appointment, qualifications, and his ability to do what he's been asked of him. Any further discussion on that? Okay, Alisa, you wanna, hate to put you on the spot, is there anything new on the oversight board?
No, unfortunately.
Or the commission?
No, unfortunately, budget? No word, no updates on the budget, which means that the latest information, which is that BNF had denied request to disperse the monies for anything, either the budget, the position, that still stands. I have not heard. I have delivered all the paperwork for the oversight coordinator position, the nominees, to the governor's office. I have not heard anything since they were delivered.
Okay.
Lisa, I want to talk about something I'm very concerned about. Krishna forwarded to Mark a budget document for requesting money for next year. And we need substantial help in filling out these documents. I have not done one in many, many years. I didn't do anything as deputy director as the executive director of the Office of Youth Services. I did that a lot. But what concerned me about what was forward to us, first of all, we are funded through a bill. We are not part of the existing budget. The form that was forwarded to us is for reduction of program. I don't understand how we submit a BNF form for reduction of program when, number one, we are not currently in the regular state budget. And we need assistance with this, and we need professional assistance with this. So I got to get that message through. And if we go back to Krishna, we'll go back to Krishna. But David Moore or someone has to provide us with the assistance in doing this work.
Okay.
Thank you. This is for the next biennium. This is for the next biennium that they forwarded it. And the next biennium budget is being formulated by the executive branch right now. So it's important.
So that's where we stand, fellow commissioners. Any assistance with my calls to the BNF have not been returned. Trying to figure out who made the call. I believe I read an article that someone wrote. Sorry, I can't remember that. They called BNF, and BNF said that due to the crisis, the money was being denied. I haven't confirmed that. It's just been a frustration for the commission in trying to get answers from the BNF, Department of Budget and Finance. And if we don't have the funding for the position, I'm not sure if the governor is aware of it, and that's why the selection is not being made at this time. We continue to try and establish the communication so we can get viable answers to this issue.
Mark, Mike down here. I know Senator Nishihara is very interested in getting the money through, but he's only one senator. He's a good guy, and he has a strong interest in making this work. So, FYI.
Well, this right now, what is happening is the among the executive only. They are creating the executive budget, which the governor will present. And so that's what we need to work on to make sure we're included in that. But it was very discouraging to get paperwork that was talking about reduction of programs.
Yeah. Yes, very well aware of Senator Nishihara and Representative Takayama and their concern over the commission. But like Martha just said, these are all in the executive level right now, the executive budget. So that's where all the control is at this particular point in time. So let's just continue to tread the water that we're treading and try to accomplish what we hope to accomplish. Thank you for those. Thank you for that report, Lisa. Appreciate it. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to open up for public testimony on
Mark,
the agenda.
Mark, first we're going to talk about the letter from Common Cause.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Martha. Go ahead.
So Common Cause submitted a letter to us, and I want to make it very clear that they also submitted a letter to Fred and to the department, and it concerns ensuring that our inmates get the proper access to voting, to registering and actually voting, those who are eligible to vote. And I first want to ask Shari, have you folks responded, or what are you doing in this area right now?
Martha, this is Shari. This is the first time I'm hearing of it. I will have to get back to you once I can find out.
Okay, Sandy Ma, who's the executive director, in her letter, she said that a similar request for information and cooperation was forwarded via email on September 9th to Special Master Fred Hune and Deputy Director Maria Cook.
Oh, okay. Then I'll follow up with them.
And the public should know that every 2 years, inmates who are eligible are allowed to vote while incarcerated. And the Women's Voters League have participated with us in this area for years. So it's not something that we've deprived them of. So I just think it's making sure that everything is taking place. Thank you, Shari.
Yeah. Shari, this is Ted. We actually have been doing that, working with the Office of Elections for decades, actually, to make sure that the inmates who are eligible to vote have access to their ballots. So it's not a matter of reinventing the wheel. There may not be a problem, but it definitely needs to be checked up.
Okay, no problem.
Thank you.
I want to try and put all you guys on the screen right now so I can see. Open up for testimony and for those items that we have just discussed, ladies and gentlemen, at this time. Those of you who I can't see, if you just yell out a name, I'll pull you up. But those of you who I can see, I'll start with Dan.
All right. Aloha, Kako. Thank you all, first of all, so much for what you're doing. You're voice and oversight at this time is so necessary, and I'm just grateful that you're doing it, even if you're not being supported by the state. I just wanted to report out a little bit on what's happening here. I'm on the Big Island of Hawaii. Here on the west side of the island, though, in Captain Cook, have been trying to. I've noticed that there seems to be a gulf between what the state officials are saying when they're trying to describe what's happening on the neighbor islands versus what actually is happening on the neighbor islands. At the last commission meeting, Eddie Mercero said he didn't want to step on anyone's toes or, you know, try and speak for anyone about what's going on, but that there was a plan that was being employed or deployed here at on the Big Island. And in follow-up meetings with the people that he was saying had the plan, it became very clear that the plan wasn't very robust. So I would encourage the commission, if they could get anyone to come from the Big Island to be able to come and talk from the regional board or anyone from the DOH here in the state or in the county to be able to come and talk about what the plan is here. I think it would be rather eye-opening just to see the lack of any sort of transitional housing or support that could be provided. And really what we're doing right now is we're testing our luck. We had a positive that was in that showed up in Hope Services, which is our big congregate living facility for homeless individuals. Thankfully, they tested everyone else and found out that they were all negative. But you know, there's a lot of questions in my mind, at least from the public health perspective, of how accurate that testing would be based on timing of exposure and things like that. So I just think it would be really great if you could call people to question really what is happening on the neighbor islands, because I think it is a very different picture from what people in Oahu are saying is happening on the neighbor islands. One more thought from my work is that, you know, when we talk about riots or things happening inside a facility, if we look at this as a phenomenon of people who might be distressed or in stress and not have a lot of input in what's going on and who are acting out in the only way that they can, I think that changes the perspective on the way that we're looking at these phenomena. And I think also changes the way that we ought to be responding to them and thinking about our duties to these folks who are trapped there, a lot of them pre-trial, without any hope of being able to even know or understand or have any control over their own situation. That's all I wanted to say. I'm sorry, one more final thing is that I did communicate with DHS about enrollment in MedQuest and trying to help people get enrolled in MedQuest. DHS has said that they are willing and interested in talking to the commission, but they tried to come and talk before and said that it was closed. And obviously that has not been my experience as I show up here and start talking often. So I think DHS is open and willing to communication about enrollment in MedQuest because that is such an important part of supporting people on the outside. How are they going to get services? How will those all be paid for? The answer to that is Medicaid. So enrollment and eligibility establishment for folks who are coming out is really essential. And there's a lot of buck passing that's happening. And so also folks from DHS would like to come and talk. I think that'd be really good too for all of you. So thank you all again for what you're doing.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate your work up there on the Big Island. Kat, you ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay.
Aloha, everybody, and thank you so much to the commission for working under untenable circumstances, and we really do appreciate your forthcoming every meeting involving the community. I've been receiving lots and lots of calls from inside facilities and from families outside, and there's a lot of concern about Saguaro because they keep moving people and putting them in the same pods. And that has been really concerning to people who were, especially our people who were just moved there. And they're finding that 150 guys moved in, I think from Idaho, and many of them tested positive and they were not put in quarantine. They were right near our guys who were not positive. So it's been a problem. There's not testing there and there's a lot of concern. Also, at Halava yesterday, and I've been hearing that this has been happening also at Saguaro. The department is handing out next of kin forms for people to sign, and it is freaking out families and people inside because they feel like, oh my God, I have a death sentence. So that's a problem. Yesterday, I had a long talk with the healthcare administrator at Public Safety. And what I found interesting is they keep saying, we're going to be testing, we're going to be testing. On April 6th, he told me, oh, we're going to be testing everybody. And that is, you know, 5 months later, we still haven't tested most people. And yet the churn is happening. And what is going on now is in the community, people are saying, oh my goodness, those inmates are causing, you know, an outbreak in the community when it's actually the opposite. The inmates were inside and the virus came into the prison. So they did not bring it out into the community. It's been, you know, the churn has been happening. And that has sort of fueled the prosecutors and the chief of police in Honolulu to keep characterizing everybody as if everybody is Charles Manson, when we have so many people in prison and in jail who have substance misuse problems, mental health problems, literacy, unemployment, a whole host of social problems that we never, ever used to incarcerate for. But now everything has become a felony, and that has really swelled the population and has really discounted justice. And that's been a huge problem in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Kat. Those of you who I can't see, if you just shout a name out, I'll put you on if you have anything you add.
Barbara.
Okay, hi, Barbara.
You're muted, Barbara. You're muted.
Thank you, Kat. Okay. Now I'm... Yeah, I'm Barbara Polk, and I just have a quick question. This time and in the last meeting, I heard nothing about the Women's Correctional Center on Oahu, and I don't know whether any testing is going on there, whether there have been any cases there. But it bothers me that there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest in what's happening there. So maybe that's kind of included in terms of other facilities other than OCCC and Halaba on Oahu, but I would like to see a little more attention to that as well. I think the commission's doing a great job, and I wish you had the support to be able to really do everything you want to do.
Thank you, Barbara. Appreciate it. We'll follow up on that, you know. Some of the facilities are really doing great in handling this situation, and maybe that's why we're not hearing from them. But we'll go ahead and see if we can get something and add those questions onto our list that we'll be presenting to public safety.
Mark, I just want to make a comment. I think what Barbara just brought up is a good point. But the women's facility, Mike, I would imagine would be classified more like a prison than a jail, because the yes. The jail women jail inmates would be at OCCC, and so if it's we haven't paid as much attention to the women's facility as to OCCC, that would be the reason why, because the women who are newly admitted into the system go to OCCC instead of WCCC. Of course, in the neighbor islands, women who are newly admitted go to the respective CCCs on the island.
No, thank you.
But we'll still follow up as well as those Arizona questions, Kat.
And for Barbara's information, you know, for everyone's information at the PSD website, they do have a spreadsheet that they is updated as of yesterday. And that shows, and anybody can go to it, and shows that 18 women have been tested and 18 women came up negative. We don't know the dates, Barbara, of those particular tests, but it does show that some testing has taken place.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else I see online wish to make a comment? Not hearing or seeing any response to that. That kind of brings us to an end of where we are at this particular point in time. Whew. Thank you, everybody, for participating. A lot of subjects going on, a lot of things going on. Bear with us as we continue
Mark, before we close. Mark?
Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, okay. This is, it's more than a housekeeping matter, but you know, we did get an inquiry about our minutes and about posting our minutes on the website. And so we need to get that done. But coming back to today's meeting, we recorded the meeting. We've made a lot of commitments in terms of the follow-up letter. How do we capture all of this and post it properly in accordance with the law?
In my Zoom awareness, I send this recording goes into a cloud that Zoom manages for me, and then they send it back to me once it's all, whatever they do is done. And I'm going to be forwarding that link to Lisa to upload.
Yeah, yes, but long-term, Mark, we need to have written minutes that will be in the archive of the state, not a recording.
Actually, OIP does allow for audio or video recordings to be used as minutes, so to speak. They do require a kind of summary or outline of the recording so that people can follow along or find a specific agenda that they're interested in. But they do accept audio or video recordings as minutes per se. You don't have to do both. I have done minutes I've posted recordings, audio recordings of the first three meetings, I believe. I have been trying to, I guess, link up, so to speak, with Mark about the recordings. I believe he has recorded the July 28th meeting, yes, or subcommittee meetings, and from then on. And I also have located a few other audio recordings of meetings that I'm going to post as well to the AG website. So they're being filled in. I think there's a meeting from May and June that I have yet to locate a recording of, but they are being posted. Bear with the technology. I do apologize. I'm learning as well with Mark as to how to upload recordings to website.
Lisa, you need to help us advocate for the release of our funds so we can get staff to do this.
I know. You don't believe I'm advocating for staff? I mean, otherwise it's me. And I'm just as technically illiterate as everybody else here. So I'm learning as I go. So,
Mark, Mike Town here, can I have a moment?
Sure.
Yes, Mike.
I would like to meet at least monthly, if not sooner, because it drags on to set this. We need to have a regular time to meet. We're going to get more and more action. We've got a special master. I believe that we'll have a director after October 1, hopefully. So but that's up to my colleagues.
We can set for October 15th.
Okay. Yep.
And my concern about the special master is that his report may be a confidential report.
Yes.
Oh. I hope not.
Okay.
Paying for it.
Mark. One more issue. What's our plan, including timetables for the emergency capacities? We're inviting public comment. We're waiting for the Department of Public Safety to produce comment. What happens after that?
That's a good question. It's just an assessment of the comments, and thank you for reminding us. You know, we'd appreciate all of you who are looking at that emergency capacity and giving us some feedback on how you feel about that, and maybe some insight or some additions or deletions. When we hear back from the Department of Public Safety, that may be another discussion to what is the next step. Yeah. In formulating, and correct me if I'm wrong, Martha, in formulating the report, actually Martha already talked about it. A lot of it is not on public safety. A lot of it is on the other systems that influence or take or input into the system of public safety. And so really the document we wanted, what the purpose for the document is to begin some serious conversations at government levels. So the next step, Ted, would probably be to write those letters to those agencies and say, hey, we need to come together and we need to have discussed this and how do we resolve the issue at this time. That's what I'm thinking off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, so leave the, I mean, the report, we do want comments on the report and may make amendments based on the comments, but what you just suggested, Mark, as we forward the report to the people in the legislature, people in the courts, that cover letter is going to become very important because that's what we're going to be saying. Yep. This requires everybody participating, not just public safety.
What does that mean? That means the county police chiefs, the county prosecutors, many of the judges in the judiciary, at least the head judges, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, Ted?
Yeah, I'd like to offer a clarification. I think there are two parts to our capacity setting authorization. Number one is to establish the capacities themselves. This would be discrete numbers. The second part is to formulate policies and procedures that will to make sure the Department of Public Safety lives within the capacities. I think setting the capacities themselves requires a little bit of knowledge, a sense of standards, a sense of acceptable practices, a sense of what's legal. Have we been invaded again?
I don't know.
Their thing just came up, Sandy Ma. Sandy Ma, can you mute your mic, please? Thank you.
The other part is where I think the other justice agencies would have a real stake in terms of, for example, what are the practices on bail? What are the practices on pretrial release, on parole, et cetera, et cetera? So that's just my opinion on this.
And the two resolutions that were forwarded to the 2019 legislature about bail and changes in corrections are really very good starting points for us. As Bob Mer said, we don't need to reinvent the wheel.
I agree. Mike, any last words?
Characteristically, no.
Okay. Judge Ibarra?
No, thank you.
Okay. Once again, to my fellow commissioners, thank you for being here this morning. Thank you all who are here at this meeting from the community. We appreciate your help and your passion and commitment as well. And we look forward to seeing everybody again on October 15th. We got a lot of work to do in the next 4 weeks, and we hope to have some better answers for you in October. So everybody,
thank you, Mark.
Stay safe out there, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Aloha.
Aloha. Aloha.